We've got a couple of gentlemen joining us here. We're going to talk high-flying adventures, we hope. Pat Halloran and Rich Graham, they are two SR-71 pilots, and good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Pat, you've been around this this neck of the woods a time or two. You're a longtime EAA-er.
You know, as a matter of fact, I've got a four-digit EAA number. And there's not many of those around, I don't think.
There are not, no. That's the one thing with EAA. I've been a member for a number of years. I have a six-digit number. But there's always someone who's got a five, and now I find somebody who's got a four.
Four.
Yeah. So, Pat, we're looking back and remembering Paul Poberesny and his legacy. Before we get into the high-flying stories, any recollections of Paul you'd like to share with folks today?
You know, I hadn't thought about that. The first time I ever met Paul, I was still on active duty, and I was flying on a weekend cross-country in a T-33, and Paul was still in the guard over at Milwaukee. And I had to land there because I was running out of fuel. I got screwed up on the weather, so I had to land there. I hadn't planned it. It had been a big ice storm. And I landed. They had shut down flying, but I had to land. And the runway was pure ice, and I'm skidding sideways and backwards and everything else and thinking I'd probably just screwed up an airplane. But finally got it under control and taxied in, and Paul was sitting there in the ops looking at me like, what in the heck are you doing here? I had never met the man in my life till then. But, of course, since then we've had so many wonderful occasions to talk to him and listen to his histories. And he's had me up in his home about 2 years ago and took me back in his memorabilia hangar and spent a couple hours with me talking about it.
Yeah. He's definitely was one to preserve history. Lots and lots of artifacts that he had. I believe he has just about every letter anyone ever sent him.
Yeah, I would agree. Looking at the collection he has.
Well, good. Yeah. Well, you gentlemen are here and enjoying the show so far?
Absolutely, yeah.
Loving it.
Good.
Every year it just seems to get better and much more attractive things. And you get super things like that big GB and wow.
Yeah, that was fun to watch that fly yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So as we're talking about SR-71s, there's been a resurgence, I feel, I don't know if it's true or not, but just in my own personal opinion, sort of a resurgence in the interest in the SR-71 program in the last couple of years. Am I just perceiving something wrong, or is there more interest?
Well, Rich kind of handles most of our seminar stuff. He's the organizer and keeps us out of line, so he probably is up to speed on that better than I am.
All of the SR-71 museums that have them on display, they quite often ask us to go as a group and have a symposium with SR-71 crew members. So all the museums where they have the 31 remaining SR Blackbirds, they ask us to come out quite a bit. And there seems to be a big market out there. There's a generation of kids come along. They want to know more and more about this airplane that went Mach 3. So
great. Rich, how did you get started in aviation?
I started with my dad. He was a Navy pilot, flew the Corsair, and as a kid, I used to see him hide his, when he became in the reserves for the Navy and flying the Corsair still at Olathe, Kansas, he would hide his flying gear in a closet. And he told my brother and I, don't ever touch that stuff. Of course, as soon as he and my mother went out for the night, my brother put the helmet on and the leather gloves and everything. So he got me inspired, and he actually had his instructor's rating and taught me how to fly when I was a teenager. And the rest is history.
What was your solo?
I soloed a Piper Colt.
Okay.
And it still exists today, and I've tracked it down. It's up in Ohio, and it's well-maintained still.
Very good. Pat, how about you?
Well, my first encounter with aviation was when I joined the aviation cadets for the Air Force. And I did that because the Korean War was just starting, and I was about to get drafted in the Army. And a recruiter talked me into going into the Air Force and becoming an aviation cadet. And, of course, once I did that, I got a taste of aviation for real. I just forgot about everything else and stayed with it.
Tell us a little bit about the development of the actual SR-71. What was the original call for proposals for airplanes?
Originally, the CIA was the original user, if you will, and the first airplane developed was called the A-12 and built by Lockheed Martin Skunk Works with Kelly Johnson as the brains behind the plane. So he did a good job, and the CIA had a void. They wanted to get an airplane that they thought, after Gary Powers got shot down on May 1st of 1960, they were thinking about getting an airplane that would go higher and faster than the U-2, and that's where they came up with the SR-71. It was evolutionary. If you ever look at some old drawings that Kelly did, it started out with an A-1, an A-2, an A-3, all the way up to what he finally came to was an A-12, which was the predecessor to the SR-71.
Were there any other manufacturers in competition with Lockheed at the time?
I think it was General Dynamics.
Yeah, GD did have a concept, and it was given tuck in terms of performance estimates. I don't recall seeing any drawings of what GD had in mind, but they were in the bidding process.
But Lockheed obviously wins the contract, and they begin producing the airplanes.
Yeah.
So at this point, they're all going to the CIA, correct?
The A-12s.
Yeah,
A-12s.
First 15.
That's it.
Yeah, first 15. 15 bodies.
Okay.
No, they look the same pretty much. Of course, one's one seat and one's two seat. That's a pretty basic one.
And the reason for the single or double seat configuration?
Well, the single seat that the CIA obviously and the makers and users thought that they only needed one pilot. They didn't need a navigator in the back. When the SR-71 became developed, they realized this is going to be used all around the globe, and we've got to put another seat in the back to have a navigator in the back to control all the systems and all the sensors and make sure that you're on target all the time.
Yeah, and another thing, the CIA airplane had one big, beautiful camera, bigger than the ones that we carry. But that's the compartment where we now have a back seater, and we carry a whole bunch of stuff. We get mini cameras and radar images and ELINT and stuff. So our capability was far beyond the A-12, and we needed that space in the back seat. So because somebody's got to run all that stuff, we're too busy flying the airplane.
We should probably put this in historical context as far as what was going on in the world, is we're getting farther and farther away from the Cold War, and especially the beginnings of the Cold War. I think young people have kind of lost that sense of what the world was like in the 50s and 60s. Can you kind of put a little context as to why the CIA would want these kinds of airplanes?
Well, of course, originally the CIA was flying the U-2 over the Soviet Union. That was the ultimate on the CIA operation. And when Gary Powers was shot down, and President Eisenhower said, we're not going to do that anymore, he told that to the people. Well, in the meantime, they're building this magnificent replacement. And they weren't really allowed to fly it the way it was designed to be flown, in the places they're designed to be flown. So it was rather an inconvenient thing to have this magnificent airplane and not be able to use it the way it was designed initially.
What were the restrictions that were put on those missions? That it couldn't fly to its capacity.
Well, ever since, like you said, since the Eisenhower era, right, there were no more manned overflights of the two superpowers, meaning Russia and China. You can name probably about any other third world country in this globe, and the SR-71's been over, but it's never, ever been over the landmass of Russia or China. We covered the periphery a lot. We covered up in Murmansk. They had the Soviet's second largest naval fleet headquarters. We'd cover that a lot for the Navy. Over on the Pacific side at Vladivostok, we covered for the Navy, the seaport over there, looking for nuclear submarines, combatants, and so we could tell the Navy who's in port and who's out at sea.
When was the first operational missions for the SR-71? Which year?
Oh, my gosh. I think it was 68.
1968.
Okay, so really the height of Vietnam and the Cold War definitely in play at that point.
Yeah, because we got our first airplane in January of 66, and by 68 we were fully operational and committed to go over and participate basically in Vietnam. But all these peripheral missions, as Rich was just talking about as well.
Yeah.
And Pat, what years did you fly the SR?
I was in the very beginning of the program. I've been flying the U-2 for 9 years, and 8 of us came out of the U-2 program to go up and start help start the SR-71. So I got there in '65, checked out in '66, and I spent about 5 years. Went to school for a year and then came back for another 2 years.
Okay.
So I wrapped it all up as the wing commander in '75.
And Rich, how about for you?
I got there in '75. In fact, this gentleman right here hired me into the program as a wing commander when I was a young captain.
Okay,
I came out of
you can't always choose right. You know, just...
I came out of F-4s and I saw the SR flying around the skies of Okinawa, Japan, where I was flying the F-4, and I said, you know, it's time for a change, and I applied, and they accepted me, and I went out for my interviews and got hired in 1975. Flew it for the next 7 years.
Okay. Sounds good. We're going to take a break, but we'll come back and talk more about the actual missions that the SR-71 was flying. We'll do that in just a moment. From the stand, this is EIA Radio.